I'm Eric Allen for KLCC. The Eugene Symphony welcomes one of this era's preeminent instrumentalists as saxophonist Branford Marsalis arrives for a performance and educational residency this week. He'll perform with the Eugene Symphony on Thursday, January 22nd on Jacques Ibert's Concertino de Camara and John Williams's Escapades. He'll also teach classes for middle and high school students, lead discussions at the UO, and coach both the UO and LCC jazz bands. Branford Marsalis joins me in the KLCC studios. Thanks for taking a little time today, Branford.
Pleasure, Eric. Good to see you.
Well, even at the level of mastery you've achieved, music can always present challenge and opportunities for growth, both as a musician and a human being. How does Ibert's piece challenge you in that regard?
Well, it's always going to be my favorite because it was the first one I ever tried, and it was really bad. And it was a great moment, a humbling moment, but it's a great moment because, you know, people tell you you're good. Eventually, you start believing it. And when they told me I was good in my 20s, I didn't believe them. But by the time I was in my 40s, I was like, yeah, I'm pretty good at this. And it wasn't just that it was bad. It was just that the little river. See, we call them chasms when they're really not talking about this genre stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality is that we all use the same 12 notes. So it's really... it's not a new language. It's just new dialect. And the little river seemed so wide because it's one thing when something's bad. It's another thing when you're playing it and you don't know it's bad. And then you play it and then you hear it and you go, my God, that's bad. So that was, it was a great kind of exhilarating feeling to know that there's so much more to learn. And it kind of inspired me to get back to work at an age when the reverse process starts in whatever it is that you do. When you become really good at something and you know you're good at it, the impetus to practice diminishes significantly and you just start relying on the little devices that you've worked out over the years, and the slippery slope becomes a mountain. And by the time you're 60, 65, you're basically rehashing 30 years prior. And if I could avoid that situation, I was more than happy to jump at the opportunity, and classical music gave me that opportunity to avoid that.
What is it about Ibert's piece that is so particularly challenging from a technical perspective?
Well, I think anytime you have a composer that has a strong sense of melody and is writing for an instrument with which they're not familiar, it is going to, the technical barrier is going to leap up a few notches, because they don't know what the instrument can play and can't. So that was the challenge of it. Just, mm-hmm. You're playing it and say, man, do people really play this? And then there are recordings of people actually playing it to just, you know, rub a little acid in the wound. You know, you can hear Marcel Mule play it, or Eugene Rousseau play it, or a lot of college kids, like a guy who is in the Navy now. I heard this guy, Doug O'Connor, play it when he was at the University of Maryland, and I was just sitting there saying, wow, you know. They are so much better than me at this. It's humbling and it's awesome.
You know, technical difficulty is not in itself a compositional virtue from my perspective. Music needs to have emotional content to be successful as well. So beyond the technical difficulty that Ibert managed to put in this, perhaps because he wasn't a saxophone player and didn't know the limits, what about the emotional content of this music makes it stick for you?
Well, for me, I think that melody creates, sound creates the emotion, but it starts with the melody. And unlike a lot of saxophone music, it is melodic. It's not the greatest. It's not the Glazunov concerto, which is unbelievably melodic. But it's very singable. And I think that makes a big difference. A lot of saxophone music, like a lot of modern jazz, none of it's really singable. And that's one of the reasons it is so poorly received, is because classical listeners get, I call it a bad rep. They get a bad rep because it's presumed that they are significantly different than people who listen to other forms of music, when I found that it's pretty much the same. Everybody likes a song with a good beat and a great melody. That's why more people know Bolero than know La Mer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, It's so infectious. It's catchy. You can sing it. You don't feel like you're lost in the middle of it. You don't have to know a lot about music to know what's going on. And that's the challenge. That's what I think somebody like Stravinsky did so masterfully, is they wrote these really complex pieces, but you can sing all of them. They're incredibly melodic, and you don't need to know a lot about music to know what's going on. And that's one of those things that Ibert did in the piece. The piece is exciting. But it's not really a second move, an adagio movement, but there's like a little, very, very tiny adagio movement, and it's really pretty. And then it just gallops at the end. And you have this really, you know, gnarly cadenza, which I play my own, part of his and part of my own.
The Williams piece has some definite differences from Ibert's take, and Williams is one of those composers who's managed to create compositions that do stick in people's minds, primarily through film music, or often through film music. One of the things about the Escapades piece is it merges classical elements and jazz elements, which is a parallel to your own background in a certain way. Is that one of the reasons that this piece has drawn you?
No, I never really thought about it until I actually heard myself rehearsing with the North Carolina symphony. I'd never really thought about the fact that he had essentially notated a jazz band with a solo.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard the piano playing behind me, and I said, wait a second, the piano player's comping. The bass player's walking. Holy crap. So it completely changed the way I phrased the solo. I made it more jazzy through accents, through accentuation. Mm-hmm. I definitely jazzed it up, but stayed, all the notes are the same, and I didn't add any of the jazz affectations like growls and bent notes and all those things, but the rhythm of it, I changed the rhythm, because if you look at the way he wrote it, he wrote this rhythm in using slurs without accents. So that's very cool. That's very cool, but the thing that John Williams does best is he creates fantastic melodies that you can put in your pocket, as Darius Milhaud said in this interview in the Book of Great Composers. He says, the most challenging thing in music is to write a melody that is so infectious that the everyman wants to put it in his pocket and take it home with him. Mm-hmm. And to him, that was the absolute thing. Like, all the other stuff was necessary. Learning all the harmony, learning all the technique, it is necessary, but that is not the thing. The mm-hmm. thing is, and ultimately, I kind of agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And John Williams does that great, even though the big difference is, I mean, John Williams' music sounds really American. It's kind of amazing to me, because I never really thought of, like a lot of Aaron Copland's music, the Lincoln Portrait sounds very American, and Appalachian Spring sounds very American, but the New Mexico Suites and Symphony No. 2, you wouldn't say, oh, that's very American. It's very tradition, like the European tradition. But Mr. Williams' music, there's like at the end of the first movement, every audience kind of chuckles when it's over. And I've noticed this after multiple performances. Like, how do you get something in the sound? It's almost like a reflex action. And if it happened in one audience, you'd say, wow. But if it happens in 15 audiences where it ends and they'll, and it's, he understands how to use sound to make people have an emotional response to his music, particularly Americans.
Can you define a little bit more specifically why it's so American? What characterizes American? Yeah.
It's empirical mm-hmm. observations based on, I've played it in Europe and people have hated it. Mm. You play it in America and every audience loves it to the point that they're standing up at the end of it. So it's much like listening to these two song forms that predominated early American popular music. One is the George Gershwin song, I Got Rhythm. The chord changes mm-hmm. from that. There were so many songs based on that. And prior to that, there was an old New Orleans song called Millenburg Joy, which was also used as the chord sequence for Tiger Rag. And the more I listened to early music from McKinney's Cotton Pickers and Duke Ellington's band and Basie Band, these two songs were like, and the blues, they were the predominant song forms for all the songs. So now those sounds are kind of hardwired in our DNA. So even when I've played for audiences that I know don't listen to jazz on a regular basis, if you play the rhythm changes sequence, they have an emotional reaction to it.
Sometimes our emotional reaction to music is really subconscious, isn't it?
Totally subconscious. Yeah. It's totally subconscious. And sometimes it's manipulative. And it's I think back to being the nerdy musician, going on a date in 1975 or four when Jaws came out, and whenever Doom started, all the women would start screaming because they knew it was coming. And I'm sitting next to Wynton, and I'm going, "Wow, man, that's a really great effect." And the girl I was with, Sherry Johnson, like, "Effect? What are you talking about?" It's like, you notice how he uses the low basses to create the sense of fear. She goes, "You think too much. Just watch the movie." But it was really interesting because I had a detached view to watch how people in the audience that don't know a thing about music, the music would spur them into an emotional response. And so I always remembered that about him, that he had that skill.
Well, the Williams piece is one you discovered through a movie, through its place in Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can.
Right.
Talk about the experience of first hearing that music in the movie context when you were in the theater.
Well, the way it's written is very different than the way it was used, but I was really struck by how effective it was, how effective the saxophone as a lead instrument in that setting and not in a jazz setting. I was really struck by how effective it was throughout the piece. And I sent an email to his management company. Just, "Hey, I'm a saxophone player. Just saw Catch Me If You Can. Mr. Williams should really consider expanding this piece." And the next day I got an email saying, "You know, thanks for your email. It'll be out in 6 weeks." So I said, well, at least he was thinking ahead. It really, first time I heard it, I said, yeah, this would be a good one to expand.
Some parallel thoughts going on between you there, then.
The man's got skill. What kind? It's a fun piece to play. And for whatever reason, I think technically the Ibert is harder, but I struggle the most with the Williams, and I've never been able to figure out why. The third movement just, I don't know. It's one of those things. Hopefully this time it would be different because I'm really working on it. But it's just parts of it. I can't find my more, and I tend to rush a little more than I'm supposed to, and everybody's chasing me, which I hate because I don't have that problem in any other form of music. And I really practiced hard to kind of minimize that. I think it's an excitement thing. The notes are difficult, and you get anxious, and it's not, and the only real rhythm is, well, no one really, it's just me because a lot of stop times, you know, bump, bump, and I get a little brisk. I get a little quick, but I'm looking forward to it.
The challenge, the education, it's never over, is it?
Never over.
That's the most beautiful thing about the whole musical process.
Never over. There's always something.
So let's talk about the educational components of your residency. There's such a great range of ages of kids that you're going to be speaking to here, including some people at very early ages in which they're not really truly musicians yet.
Right.
I think of your own childhood and the remarkable musical family you came from. Are there things that come out of your own family background that help you impart musical inspiration to young kids?
Probably. Definitely the combination of my family background and New Orleans, growing up in a city like that. I played in a school band. I played in the youth orchestra. I played in a traditional New Orleans band for youth, started by Danny Barker, who was the banjo player who played with Armstrong in Chicago and in New York, came back home and started the Fairview Baptist Church Jazz Band. And you never heard any of the principals sniping about the other situations. You know, Mr. Demborian, youth orchestra guy, said, "You playing in the Fairview Band? That's great, man. I'm glad you're doing that." And then I come to rehearsal a little late with the Fairview, and they say, "Man, how was orchestra, man?" You know, not, "Man, why are you playing that nonsense?"
Uh-huh.
And when I left New Orleans, I noticed that there was this kind of insecurity-based sniping that goes on between genres or mediums or the people who play. So how I address kids is that, like, in a lot of ways, all these things are equal, even though as you dig into the weeds, they're not really equal. But they're equal in humanistic terms because all music tries to achieve the same goal for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, they're the same. And I'm a stickler about definition because there was a thing that happened 30 years ago when suddenly the most important thing in jazz became soloing, improvisation, which is complete fabrication. So when I talk to students, it's more about let's deal with the definition. I'm not going to try to turn you into something that you don't want to be, mm-hmm. but I will make sure that we understand what the definitions are so that you don't think that you're doing something that you're actually not doing. And that's mostly for the college kids. I don't really get into that with the junior high and high school kids because it's not like 1935 when you turn on the radio and Bessie Smith is on.
Yeah.
Katy Perry's on now. So it's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So the environment that surrounds you is not the environment that created those players. So for the rare couple of people who actually want to pursue that as a career, we can get to that later. We can get to the really intense, hard stuff later.
I would imagine there comes a line as an educator between needing to support and inspire, particularly when they're very young, and getting to the place where a musician is really ready for a critical voice and needs the constructive criticism as well. How do you sense when a student is ready for that next level of challenge and constructive criticism?
Most students are never really ready for it.
Yeah.
Particularly. I grew up under the notion that you're not as good as you think you are and you're not as smart as you think you are.
Yeah.
A lot of the students that I teach did not grow up under that paradigm. So the first time that they figure out that they're not as good as they think they are is when they walk into my class or Joey Calderazzo's class, and they come out very disillusioned.
Uh-huh.
So most of my students were never really ready for that.
Yeah.
They weren't ready for it emotionally, and they definitely weren't ready for it intellectually. But the way I figure is once you get to college, that's just too bad. it's almost big boy time, you know. So when you're in high school and junior high school, all I'm going to really stress is that if they really want to play jazz better, they have to listen to it more, and that's pretty much what it's going to be. I'm not going to dig in the weeds and start talking about tone and reproduction and all the other stuff. Yeah. You know, making sure, because most kids, just like most people in our country, we are not a country that actually listens to music for the most part. We're very English that way. If you study the history of classical music, you notice that in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, there's no English composers that rise up in the discussion. Mm. England was very different. The spoken word was more important than the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Plays were super popular, as we all know. Poetry was really popular, and poetry was popular in France as well, but music and melodicism and all those things were really important. So culturally, we tend to participate in our music. You know, we always do other things while it's on, whether it's go to brunch, which is when you hear Baroque music at brunch, because we don't want you to talk too loud. But at a bar, you play really loud music because the science of a bar is kind of simple when you hire a band. The louder the music is, the more people talk. The louder they talk, the louder they talk, the more they drink. The more they dance, the more they drink. And the whole point of it is you use the music, much the way that John Williams uses music in a different context, to get people to buy and consume more of the products that the bar has to offer. So Baroque music would not be a very good style of music to support that idea. So it's when you start putting all of these things together and understanding them all in context. This is how I teach my kids. Everything is in context.
Mm-hmm.
Most music instruction is kind of like reverse engineering. And I try to kind of try to flip it the other way around. Because the way we're taught to identify what we see first and not to focus on what we hear. But you show me a great composer, this is a person, man or woman, who could hear music. And they hear a sound and then they write it down. It's not the other way around. They don't write it down and look at it and think, that doesn't look right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about what it looks like. It's about what it sounds like. And that is the one thing that I've noticed that most students, they don't know what they sound like. They're so used to reading notes that their ears aren't properly engaged.
So is listening then the key aspect of what you bring as an educator?
Absolutely. Because the mastery of any language is through immersion.
Mm-hmm.
How many of us has taken a foreign language in the United States and passed every test and then get on a plane and go to that place and the people say, I have no idea what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Because how to successfully learn a language has almost nothing to do with conjugation, yet when we teach, we tend to teach through conjugation, which because you can codify it, you can grade it that way. But if the goal is to speak, there needs to be so much oral education, so much listening, 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 and mimicry, listening and mimicry and repetition. And this is the same thing I find in music. If you can convince them to listen and to listen with a certain level of specificity and spend 1 year on one song and then go to the next song, how they hear music changes dramatically.
Music has a lot of connection with science from my perspective, and I have a scientific background in my own education, and it seemed like somehow the learning process in science and music is very parallel. What connection do you see to science and music?
I think that the musicians that are into science don't really, because you can't, it's not like a flat parallel.
Mm-hmm.
It's more in context. When a scientist comes up with a theory, they pass the theory on to their colleagues who then rip it to shreds to discredit them.
Absolutely.
In music, that creates great animosity because musicians are far more insecure than scientists. They don't understand that scrutiny is part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is I guess the way it's perceived. For instance, Einstein's discovery of the theory of relativity, the way that we learned about it in school was that it was an invention. When I started to read more and more articles just out of curiosity and read a couple of books, I realized that, and this is the way music is when it's done well, it's the same thing, is that he did not discover new information. The information that he had was the same information that all these other physicists in Europe and America had. It's just that somehow his intuition kicked in a way through constant repetition. His intuition kicked in a way that when he looked at the data, he saw something in the data that everybody else missed. And to me, that's what great music is. Because we all have the same data. There's 12 notes.
Mm-hmm.
There's infinite amount of chords, but there's not a lot of them that work. And Bach saw something in the data. He heard something in the data. Yeah. He heard it in a way that all of his contemporaries, they couldn't get to that. And it's not a lack of training. Yeah. It's just, you can't, it's a thing.
It's a combination of intuition as well as
absolutely
knowledge.
Intuition is crucial. But we kind of, in our country, we believe that intuition is just like this, like God-given natural thing that just shows up. And we talk about advancements in music as many revolutions. When you read the rhetoric that is written about any style of music, jazz music, rock and roll, when people who are from the 60s talk about the 60s, they don't talk about it as an extension of the blues from the 50s. They talk about it as a radical deconstruction of the whole system and a new system springs up, which is absurd. That's not, if you really want to look at that, then look at the progress of China after the year zero. That is what happens when you have a radical deconstruction and you just replace it with random people. It becomes a nightmare. Nothing really functions. And the way music really is that certain people extend on a pre-existing tradition. So that the music should be talked more in terms of branches on a tree, not, well, this is one tree and then that's another tree and that's another tree. Because if you study a lot of musicians that I've checked out in any style of music, they are really polyglots and they listen to so many different styles of music. And it's not about a merger, which is always the word, you know, which is the hyphenated music, the merger of this, the merger of that. It's about people who have a natural relationship with sound. And because of the music they've listened to, they understand that these sounds will work really well in this context, better than these sounds will. So it's not really this idea that you just take these two opposing things and force them together and make it work, even though that's the perception for people.
Yeah.
Sometimes even people who play music. When you read music criticism, it's always about forging new ground through collision. And a lot of times it is musical collision and there are parts and wreckage all over the place, but people can't really hear it that way. So it's not my mission to convince regular listeners. Regular listeners should enjoy what they enjoy. But music students who are serious about it, I really go after them in this way. I need them to think about what it is that they're doing and think about it in a context, instead of this kind of weird kind of blank canvas where they believe anything I throw up is fine.
Anything else about this week of residency or performance that you want to make sure that you can impart to our listeners?
Nah, I've talked enough. You got some editing to do, pal.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and taking a few minutes.
My pleasure.
Saxophonist Branford Marsalis, who will appear with the Eugene Symphony at the Holt Center on Thursday, January 22nd, with guest conductor Christian Knapp. He'll perform on Jacques Ibert's Concertino de Camara and the John Williams piece Escapades, with its roots in the Spielberg film Catch Me If You Can. Branford Marsalis will also conduct master classes and discussions at educational levels from middle school to college during his week-long residency, funded in part by a grant from the NEA. For complete information, eugenesymphony.org, and for tickets to the Holt Center performance, holtcenter.org. Also see branfordmarsalis.com. For KLCC, I'm Eric Allen.